Good afternoon, everybody. It's afternoon in New York. It's afternoon in Chicago, where my guest this week is joining us. And it's a great guest to have on because he's a guy who covered the Minnesota Timberwolves for 14 or 15 seasons as a beat writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Now one of the heavy hitters at NBA.com, and not just because he eats big lunches. Welcome to the show, Steve Ashburner. Steve, Chris Sheridan here. Thanks for coming on.
Chris, and what's that last name again? Oh, yeah. Okay. Hi, Chris. How are you? Good to talk to you. Fellow market alum, I'm glad to join you.
Yeah, there's some of us out there that will only call Marquette the Marquette Warriors. We don't say Golden Eagles, we don't say Golden Avalanche, and we don't say anything else. And then we identify with each other, and we make private jokes on Twitter, and not many guys get it, but we do. And
enjoy our political incorrectness.
Yeah, that's, you know, that goes both ways with some of the Marquette journalism alumni, and we'll just leave it at that. Because, Steve, we want to get into talking about Jimmy Butler, and we want to talk about the whole dynamic surrounding the Minnesota Timberwolves, what's going on this during this whole preseason. Now we're one day into the regular season. I think everybody expected Jimmy Butler to have been traded by now, and barring a trade before tip-off tonight, Jimmy Butler is going to take the court wearing a Minnesota Timberwolves uniform for the first time this season. Just give us kind of your lowdown on did you think it would go this long, and do you think he's going to make it onto the court tonight, or do you think we're going to see a trade prior to tip-off?
Yeah, you know what? I'm not surprised that he's in uniform. I guess if I had had to guess how he would spend this evening, I might have put in street clothes ahead of in Minnesota uniform, but I definitely would have had both of those ahead of in somebody else's uniform. I just thought things were moving too fast. I think that they were a lot of people were trying to get that thing at Jimmy Butler's pace, and there was no need for Minnesota to do that. Minnesota needed to get this thing done on their terms, at their pace, and if that means February trading deadline, I don't think that that's the worst possible thing, depending on how Butler comports himself as a member of the Minnesota team. I have been, anybody who follows my Twitter handle or has read a couple of things I've written will not be surprised by this. I've been pretty much down on Jimmy Butler and his handling of this from the start. I felt that he was within his rights when he didn't get the extension he wanted this past summer. He was within his rights to inform the Wolves privately that, just so you know, guys, I'm not going to return next summer. You might want to trade me to get something in return. Period. At that point, it should have been over, and it should have been up to the Timberwolves to make a deal that serves them, gets Butler, if to a team he wants to go to, great. If to another team that offered more in trade, that's fine and fair game as well. But when he went public with it and made it, you know, through his management or whomever, known that he wanted out with a year left on his contract, he lost me, and I just thought that was so unprofessional. It was the opposite of what a guy who's supposed to be a leader of a team does, and at that point I was sort of like, I hope it takes a while. If Jimmy Butler wants to be traded sooner, I hope it happens later.
And so, knowing what you know about the situation and the sort of the dynamics involved on that team, some of the younger players not getting along all that well with the one older player, Jimmy, who's almost 30 now at this point. That dynamic happens on a lot of teams. And it even happened with Rajon Rondo when he was with the Boston Celtics. And the big three on that team included Pierce Garnett and Ray Allen. And Kevin sort of froze Rajon out. And that didn't really go over with Rajon, who had a history of not really trusting male authority figures. When you look at the dynamic of the locker room dynamic on Minnesota and the locker room dynamic on other teams that you've covered very closely, how do these things tend to work themselves out if they are able to be worked out?
Well, I think every situation is different. It's funny you mention that. I mean, I agree. And then until Ray Allen gave them something to bond around, you know, and then Rondo and Garnett and Pierce became, you know, thick as thieves because they were all mad at Ray. So things change and are fluid, too. I do think that what we've seen is sort of the crux of the problem in Minnesota is that with Jimmy acting out, You haven't seen any direct pushback from Andrew Wiggins or Karl Anthony Towns. To the contrary, you've seen almost a submissive mode for both those guys. Wiggins has kind of ignored the issue and made himself relatively scarce. I know he and a partner were expecting their first child, so he missed some time. And Karl Anthony Towns went into deer in the headlights mode, where he just sort of answered questions perfunctorily and would not really engage. And about the only thing he did do that was notable was that he signed his extension the day after it was announced that Butler wouldn't be around the team for a while. So, you know, there's some passive aggressiveness going on there, and that's very appropriate for a Minnesota-based franchise. Minnesota Knights, people up there tend to tend towards the passive aggressiveness. And I don't know. I do think that the commitment that Minnesota has made in terms of long-term big-money extensions means they have to be mindful of any long-term effect this has on those guys. And so that to me, I think I am coming around and think that the Jimmy Butler deal is weeks away, not months away, and maybe even days. But I do believe he'll start the season, and I think he'll play a home game or two in front of the Minnesota fans. And that'll be a real joy for everybody involved. And, you know, we shall see. In a perfect world, this all would have been a put-on by Jimmy Butler as a way to challenge the medal of the young stars on his team. Nobody's getting that much credit, and it wasn't. But, you know, had Jimmy been able to throw back a curtain and say, you know what, I was trying to see how much Carl or Andrew would push back and stand up for themselves, and they failed this test, and now we go forward, you know, that would have made some sense to me. I just think it's a mess, and we'll see. And good luck to Jimmy and the team that gets him for however long, you know, the season remains, because he is a prickly personality, and, you know, he isn't done trying to steer his career and his fate.
Yeah, and look, there's places he wants to go and there's places that he doesn't want to go. We saw this over early in the summer with Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi said, you know, I only want to get traded to the L.A. teams, and so yeah. Send me there. And Greg Popovich was like, guess what? Kawhi, I'm in charge. I'm in charge of this trade. You're not in charge of this trade. And that's why Kawhi Leonard is buying, you know, ski caps and warm gloves and probably a nice fur coat, because he's going to be spending the winter in Toronto and, you know, playing for Nick Nurse. And look, if he's not going to stick around long term, then Masai Ujiri is going to have a rental on his hands. But he's also got a bunch of teams out there that would love to have Kawhi Leonard, so he could just turn him into a rental and deal him at the trade deadline. Steve, what about the odds of that happening with Jimmy? Jimmy wants to go to Brooklyn or New York or one of the two LA teams, but what if a Charlotte comes in, or what if a Houston comes in, or he has added Miami to his list, but I mean, pick a team out of the blue. Let's say a Portland came in and said, you know what, we can get him at a price we like. Let's go out and get him. You think he would be adaptable in a city that's not on his wish list?
Well, I mean, as much as Kawhi Leonard and the likelihood or possibility that he'll stay in Toronto, some people think that he'll be won over by the city, by the team there. I don't know about that. It's hard to know with Kawhi. He's such a puzzle of a person. I think it's possible. I just think that you've got teams that need to be mindful of their locker room chemistry. I mean, I think of a team like Denver. If you put Jimmy Butler onto Denver's team, onto the floor, playing with the other Nuggets, I mean, I think it's a great addition. But they also are you know, real happy with the way that their ensemble cast gets along. And does Jimmy come in there and mess up that chemistry? I think that that's a legit concern. Portland, you know, Damian Lillard and C.J. McCollum are you know, stand-up guys, and they sort of take the lead in terms of, you know, what that team is all about. Does Jimmy come in there and is he chafe with one or both of those guys? I mean, that's the X factor that Jimmy Butler has sort of introduced in this, because this is the second team where he has had locker room issues. It started in Chicago. The Bulls were fortunate, I think, to have traded him when they did and gotten what they got for him. Any team, I think, that picks Jimmy up short-term with the idea they could trade him again before the deadline, you know, that's fine, but I think the return goes down. And I think that if Toronto did it with Kawhi Leonard, they wouldn't be getting an active all-star like DeMar DeRozan back, you know, for a couple of months at that point, a couple of months plus playoffs. I think you just have to accept you're going to get less. By the way, you know, Popovich did that, and people were like, well, see, Pop's in charge. He didn't give Kawhi Leonard what he wanted. But Tom Thibodeau doesn't immediately trade Jimmy Butler and presumably to one of the teams Jimmy wants to go to, and all of a sudden Tom Thibodeau should be fired. And they hit, somehow he's derelict in duty because he's got two jobs and he's botched this and he's too loyal to Jimmy Butler. I just think the double standard that's been applied to this is kind of suspect as well.
Yeah, Tom's taking a beating. Certainly, I think Scott Layden has taken a beating publicly. Stuff got out about what was said on the phone call between Scott and Pat Riley, and there was some denials that were non-denials. Look, Scott's got a job to do, and Scott's got to hold out for the absolute best deal he can make. And Scott's notorious as a real hard bargainer when it comes to trade talks. But what about Tom Thibodeau? You know, Jimmy Butler's been very loyal to Tommy throughout his career. When Tom got the job in Minnesota, it was one of the first guys that Tibbs went out and got because he knew what he had. Fuck was that? You guys hear that? We're going to edit that out. Do you hear that?
I heard you. I just heard it go quiet.
Yeah, that was, no, it was ESPN. I had a box score up and then some sort of audio came on. Anyway, we'll pick it. This could be edited right out. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And so what about Tom Thibodeau? You know, Steve, when Tom took the job in Minnesota, one of the first players he went out and got was Jimmy Butler, and they gave up a lot. They gave up Chris Dunn, they gave up Lauri Markkanen, they gave up another player. But Tom got Jimmy for a reason because he knew that Jimmy was perfect for his system and was loyal to him. But Tommy must have missed something. After Minnesota got eliminated from the postseason last year and Jimmy Butler didn't return with the team back to Minnesota, got on his own flight and went to L.A., Tom had to know some of the details of what was going wrong in that locker room. And from the outside looking in, it appears that Tibbs just said, look, he said to Glenn Taylor, look, I'll handle this when we're back in camp. Let the situation cool down over the summer. By the time September rolls around, we'll get back into camp. I'll smooth this over. I can handle it. That seemed to be the operating plan that Tibbs was going under. And if it was, why didn't it work out?
I mean, that, you make it sound very palatable that was the way they approach it. I could see Tom, looking at Jimmy and any discontent he might have felt and figuring, well, that's fine, you know, but we got him, you know, he's under contract next year and we'll just pick up where we left off in the spring and onward and upward, and did not fully grasp the resolve that Butler brought to this in terms of getting out sooner. I think the key to me on that whole thing is that Tom and Jimmy were apart largely. I mean, they kept in touch. They texted. I know that during Tom's sabbatical year, when he was, you know, sitting out the after the Bulls had fired him, he sat out 1 year and got paid by them and prepared for his next opportunity, that he and Jimmy would, you know, occasionally be spotted at a Chicago restaurant, things like that. But he wasn't around him daily. And those, to me, were Jimmy's two most troubling years because his game had already reached all-star level, but his craving for attention and self-styled leadership, alpha dog ways were really sort of pushing over the top to the point that he had a very friction-filled season with Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah and Pau Gasol in one of those years. And then the following year, they bring in Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo, and those two guys sort of yield to Jimmy and say, well, he's the alpha dog. It's his team. And yet he and Dwayne Wade got kind of into a buddy ball situation and wound up opposite Rondo in a dispute over young players on the Bulls roster. So Tom wasn't around Jimmy when Jimmy was his most difficult and might have read the situation a little differently had he been. I thought that deal was a win-win, you know, the proverbial win-win in sports, where both teams would get what they needed badly. And I thought Minnesota would be better off. Now, when Jimmy, sort of took a dislike to the personalities of his talented teammates, namely Towns and Wiggins, you think, well, okay, there's one way to motivate guys, and that's where you chew on their butts and you know, sort of embarrass them and goat them into stepping up their game. But at some point, he's going to have to reassess if they don't respond to that and, you know, figure out when he needs to pat them on the back and draw them out. And with Tom being very much a butt chewer himself, you know, they had a bad cop situation when they needed a good cop in there somewhere. And so, you know, that's where it went south. And then for Jimmy to do the disappearing act at the end of the playoffs, you know, to me was, yeah, it's a bad sign, but what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to say, geez, we better trade the guy. You know, he's not happy. No, I mean, if you're Tom Thibodeau and you've leaned on Jimmy Butler in the past, you think there's a guy that, you know, yeah, he's angry, but I like guys to get mad when they lose. You know, nobody should be happy when they lose. And so he probably went into that mode. And they let a very pivotal summer slip away in terms of development. I know guys need their time away, but, you know, you had Jeff Teague at training camp telling reporters, I think we're behind other teams because we didn't get together at all in the summer. And that was a big mistake for a team trying to move up in the ranks of the Western Conference. So, you know, there were warning signs along the way, but nothing really flared up until it was really late. And that's why they're where they're at right now.
Yeah, you look at a team like the Milwaukee Bucks, they spent a week together in New York. And Coach Bud came with them and all the key players. They spent a week in New York in August. They played ball at the gym all day. They went out and did tourist stuff at night and had dinners together. And it was a real bonding experience for the team. And a couple of the relationships that needed to be repaired on that team were indeed repaired. And now they're going into the season feeling pretty good about themselves. They probably got the best coach who was out there on the market this summer. Giannis was in the gym, looks like a super freak now. Eric Bledsoe, if they keep him, look, he's one of the best two-way guards in the league. And you know, we'll see how the Brook Lopez thing works out. He's as soft as Charmin, and if he doesn't start rebounding, they at least have Thon Maker and John Henson who can step in and do some of the dirty work. But the Bucks are a team that not a lot of people are talking about. Aside from Giannis, who can make some noise in the East. The East is wide open. You know, seeing the Boston-Philly game last night, certainly Boston's got a leg up on them, and I don't know how long the Markelle Fultz's starter experiment is going to work, but you look at Milwaukee, you look at Indiana, and you got a couple teams that nobody talks a lot about that really could contend for the top two spots in the East. Would you agree?
I agree, and I wouldn't necessarily throw Toronto, to the curve either. I think that they won 59 games last year. They added Kawhi Leonard. If he's anything close to healthy and can appear as a starter and approach the form he had before he had that limbo year in San Antonio, I think that that's a big addition too. They think they're better off with Nick Nurse as their head coach than with Dwayne Casey. So we'll see. I mean, they stand to benefit the most psychologically from LeBron James being out of the Eastern Conference. I felt that they were beaten whenever they faced Cleveland before they stepped on the floor, just knowing LeBron was there. Not a good statement for them. It would suggest that they have, you know, soft tendencies aside from LeBron, but this is the one that had to go, and he's gone. And I think Toronto has an opportunity to flex as well. I think they're one of the top three teams in the East. Beyond that, I mean, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, Indiana, Milwaukee, to me, slot in somewhere after that, and then you get into teams that have a lot of things to prove and some clear flaws, you know, like Washington and Miami. So, Milwaukee with Budenholzer, he was a great get, and he's going to impose some order and some things that the players can lean on, because Jason Kidd, it was very helter-skelter. He had this one defensive style that the rest of the league solved when they figured out, you know what, if we pass the ball two or three times instead of once, you know, we're gonna shed those Milwaukee defenders. And I don't think anybody really knew where they stood with Jason Kidd in terms of role, minutes, rotation, any of that. And Budenholzer is smart enough and has learned enough, you know, he learned enough at Pop's knee that he'll he'll take care of all those basics, and I expect them to take a big jump. They should have taken a jump last year, but now it'll come.
Yeah, well, Joe Prunty didn't really have time to integrate a new system, a Spurs-based system. Joe was a former assistant coach on the bench in San Antonio, just like Mike is. So that some of the stuff that they're putting in this year is stuff that they saw last year under Joe. But having a whole camp to put it in, it makes all the difference in the world. You try to do that mid-season. Yeah, you try to do that mid-season, and it's like pulling a U-turn. You do it in training camp, and you can smooth it in. And I want to talk a little bit more about the East, Steve, because when you look at the odds on who's going to lead the NBA in scoring, I'm at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's the top nine guys. 8 of them are from the Western Conference. And the only guy from the East is Giannis. Giannis is plus 650 or 13-2, the odds on him leading the league in scoring. And then you get down to Kawhi Leonard at 32-1. Next guy from the East is Kyrie Irving at 38-1. And then Oladipo is 50-1. Kevin Love is 65-1. But all the chalk. And the chalk is Harden and Davis are pretty much neck and neck as the favorites. Then LeBron is 11-1, Booker 17-1, Westbrook is 17-1, Lillard and Durant both 20-1. Curry, coming off a 30-plus point game last night, he's still on the board at 27-1 to lead the league in scoring. We've seen a lot of imbalance in the NBA, West being stronger than East, and it's not the kind of thing that's going away anytime soon. Is this the most imbalanced season in terms of going into the season, strength of the West versus strength of the East that you've seen in your all your years, I think 77 years covering the NBA?
Yeah, I was wondering how far back I had to go here. In recent memory, I'll go with that, sure. And yet, I'm not one of the reactionaries that demands something be changed, that either team-wise regarding the playoff brackets or I don't know what you would do personnel-wise, but I think there's a lot of cyclical stuff to this. I mean, LeBron's been in the East, and LeBron's gotten to the finals year after year after year. If teams are down, they're supposed to get better draft position and draft good players, and those players are supposed to be nurtured and developed to the point that now they have stars on that side as well. So, it's ended up this way because of the arms race, I think, in the West, and because maybe the attractiveness of the West Coast cities for players to play in. But there's a talent gap, no doubt about it. If I'm a young player, I want to play in the East, right? You got all-star jobs to be had. You have all NBA selections that you might be able to shine a little bit more with opportunity against inferior opponents, playing them more often in the course of the season. So, I think it should work itself out. I don't think we need to gerrymander anything. But scoring wise, I don't know who the East has besides Giannis, and he has to carry the load. He's got help in Chris Middleton and Bledsoe, like you spoke of. But people expect that he'll be up in that range again of very nearly leading his team in just about every category, and sort of Scottie Pippen style, and Michael Jordan scoring average chipped in. So I don't know what to make of it. I don't know that good teams necessarily have leading scorers, if you have enough help around you. But then again, I mean, James Harden's team won how many games last year, and he led the league in scoring. So it shows you it can happen. Michael did it, obviously.
Sure, you put three great players together, and that's the formula that worked for Riley in Los Angeles. It worked for Pat Riley in Miami, and it's worked. It worked when LeBron had Kevin and Kyrie at the top of their games in Cleveland as well. You get three great guys on your team, you're going to go far, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Houston Rockets are being mentioned as a real serious contender. You put Jimmy Butler on that team, and you make up a lot of what you lost in Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute leaving as free agents over the summer. You put a third superstar on that team, along with Chris Paul and James Harden. That's a team that can go all the way to the NBA Finals. And let's not forget, Chris Paul missed Game 6 and missed Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals last year when Houston was leading Golden State 3-2, and James Harden tried to take it all upon himself in the second half of both those games. tried to do too much, got away from what they were doing in the first half, and they lost both of them, and that's why Golden State's the defending champs. But again, kicking it back to Butler, Jimmy Butler, Steve.
Yeah.
If you had to pick 2-3 teams that are most likely to end up with them, who would those 2-3 teams be?
Well, Miami still makes sense because of their situation next summer. They're not going to be able to really get in the bidding war for Jimmy Butler. You know, their cap situation is ugly, and unlike teams that are going to be able to dredge space, they're not one of those. So they want to get Jimmy Butler in the door now. So they have, you know, bird rights. They have the opportunity to persuade him and retain him rather than just go into free agency and take a shot at him there. You know, you mentioned Houston. I mean, Houston would seem like a trade destination, except they have to give up something to Minnesota. And so do they want to give up Eric Gordon? Do they want to give up P.J. Tucker? You know, what sort of player would it take to pry Jimmy loose? And to me, it makes more sense for Houston to, especially with Golden State, you know, still revving strong, for Houston to bide its time. And if they can add Jimmy, you know, in the summertime, it's a better way to go. I mentioned Denver. Denver has a deep roster, and I thought I actually thought if LeBron wanted to go somewhere and really have a chance to win in the West soon and take on Golden State, I thought if he had gone to the Denver Nuggets, it would change the complexion of that team. And Jimmy Butler can do, you know, some of those things that LeBron can do. He certainly plays two ways. That's helpful. I know that's valued in Denver under Michael Malone. And that would be a team that if they wanted to get interested, my concern with them is, like I said, they're very happy with the chemistry they have. They're sensitive to any changes in the locker room. You know, Jimmy is he's a determined guy. And some of the things I've heard about him is he wants to be the best player on whatever team employs him, you know, competition be damned. And that if he has to go in there and be the second or third best player, he may be trouble. And so a team like Houston, I mean, if James Harden and Chris Paul are already there, where's Jimmy Butler going to slot in? Would he accept that with the idea of winning, or would he rather be on a playoff team and be that, you know, quote-unquote alpha dog? So I don't know why leaving Minnesota has such an appeal to him, because that's what he is, and that's what he could remain, at least for another year, and enhance his reputation. But, you know, once he planted his flag on getting traded, he's a stubborn guy, and it's going to be hard for him to ever accept the idea of playing all 82-plus with the Timberwolves. The Clippers, that was one of the teams he allegedly wants to go to. That makes sense. I guess there's nobody there that is such a star that Jimmy didn't think he could come in and sort of wrest that crown from. So, you know, Miami, Houston, Clippers. I'd be curious to see him in a basketball sense with Denver. But beyond that, yeah, I think it's just kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah, my top three pretty much mirror your top three. I think Miami, Houston, and the Clippers are all three teams that can get it done. I think with Houston, if you're gonna put Gordon and P.J. Tucker into a trade together, bang, you're going to get it done. Miami,
yeah.
They did make Josh Richardson available, and then there was, if you believe what you read, Scott Layden asked for something extra at the end, and the guys hung up on each other. The Clippers, the Clippers have a lot of leftover pieces from Houston, from when Chris Paul got dealt there. They still have Gallinari,
yep.
Who's, you know, he can still play, he can still shoot it. He would replace the offense that Minnesota would be losing from Jimmy Butler. He certainly wouldn't replace the defense. And then it becomes a matter of what else comes along in that trade to make it palatable for Minnesota. You know, there's the thing about these about NBA trades is if a team knows that another team is really close, a team's going to change its offer. And
yeah.
And with the Sacramento Kings being out there, the Sacramento Kings having more than $40 million in expiring contracts, plus $12 million in cap room, they can broker anything. I mean, they can broker just about anything the way that Sam Hinkie used to do it in Philadelphia. So what about that, Steve? The Sacramento Kings as facilitator. If you're running the Kings, if you're Vlade Divac, what do you do? What I've heard is that Vlade's operating under the assumption that our cap space and our expiring contracts get more expensive as each day goes by. And if we're going to hang on to all this stuff until the trade deadline, it's going to be all that much more expensive in February than what it was back in October.
I think this is a tough time, you know, a tougher time for a third team to get involved because, you know, right now everybody's got the pretense of, you know what, we're going to have a better year than we had last year. We're going to win more games than we won. We're going to have improving players, and we're going to see the strides that our guys have made. And so to be a third team involved where you're facilitating a deal that helps two other teams that think they're going to be contenders, I think it's harder to do. I think maybe you get deeper into the season, closer to that deadline, and the whole idea of tanking or, you know, we're obviously seeing where we've found our level and some of those phony fall aspirations have been set aside. I think then, you know, again, a third team is maybe more willing. I think that once you're underway like this, you know, that's the worst time of all for a third team to get in there because they're involved not to get better. They're involved just for assets, and this is not the time of year. Nobody's had a losing streak yet. I don't know. I'd have to see that happen. I could see them almost getting revved up more in February than I could right now or November.
Yeah, the winds change in the NBA and things shift, and it happens year after year after year, and then trades go down that nobody was expecting, and everybody was like, hey, how come nobody had that trade? It's because the rumor mill is only run so deep, and what's being talked about versus what's being reported are not necessarily the same things. You and I both have heard enough stuff to start our own, you know, rumors, and you and I both put stuff out there that we're very careful about what we put out there because we have our reputations at stake. But the fact of the matter is reporters don't know what's going on, in 80%, 90% of the time. But there's such a market for rumor journalism, especially in terms of NBA coverage. You got to walk a fine line. And just how do you go about doing that, Steve? How did you do it at the Star Tribune? How do you do it at NBA.com? Where you're not burning your sources, but you're staying ahead of the game in terms of telling people what's what?
Well, I mean, part of it is determined by my employer. I mean, NBA.com, we're owned and operated by Turner Sports out of Atlanta on a contract basis with the NBA. But the NBA, you know, they have certain expectations of our website, and I don't necessarily blame them either. I'm not saying that we're a party line or a company line. In fact, that's the reason that I was hired, along with about five other guys, back in 2009, was to bring, you know, real sports writing or sports journalism credibility to a site that people thought might just be, you know, a PR destination full of stats and video and press releases. And so, I can say with authority that we have a great deal of latitude in what we write about. This is more a personal standard for me in that, you know, I go back far enough to when rumors were actually concocted by the writers themselves. I miss the days when Sam Smith, who works for Bulls.com now, but when he worked for the Chicago Tribune, he'd be the guy throwing and spitballing, you know, trade possibilities out there, and then you'd kick stuff around, and okay, fine. Now that stuff sort of comes from, you know, some of it comes from fans, but some of it comes from the principals, and they do it under the cloak of anonymity. The fabled anonymous sources. Back in my day, I mean, it's just like from All the President's Men. It used to be if you had anonymous sources, you needed two independent people, and it had to be factual information. It couldn't be opinions about somebody's character, and frankly, it couldn't be rumors without, you know, legitimate trade negotiation. I don't want to say discussion because, you know, we've long heard a general manager is not doing his job if he doesn't pick up the phone constantly and inquire about another team's roster. So you could say, well, they're talking to so-and-so about such-and-such, and that's sort of what their job is, and talking doesn't mean close to a deal. So what I'm saying, I guess, is I don't have the pressure that some of our brethren might feel to stay ahead of the rumor game. I think that that's clickbait material, and I'm appreciative that I work for a place that doesn't judge, sports journalism along those lines. I understand, you know, what what feeds the beast, but I also think that, you know, credible stuff feeds the beast as well. And to me, that means you don't, you know, shoot off a flare gun 10 times a day, but so that when you do shoot one off, people know, hey, there's something going on here. We have to pay attention to it. So to me, it's just it's a matter of sticking to some standards and knowing what's real. And from the people that you get to know over time, as I know you have, you know what's real, and you know when somebody's trying to use you or leverage their anonymity into something that will favor them in their jobs.
Sure, guys, agents do it all the time. They put out misinformation because they're trying to do a favor to their client. But they will lie on behalf of their client in order to create false leverage that doesn't necessarily exist. But you see it all the time on Twitter. And if you know the principles involved, I tell you exactly where this came from. This is a no-brainer. Just, you look at the way a guy writes something or the way a guy tweets something, or it tweets then writes, and then you're like, yeah, okay, I know exactly where this came from. And it's come to the point where people are using information as currency, creating good coverage for information.
Right.
On the ethics scale, Steve, where does how does that fly with you?
That's not our jobs. Never supposed to be our jobs. We're supposed to be, even as we're supposed to be experts and so-called insiders, we're supposed to always be outsiders when it comes to the participants in this stuff. You know, it's changed dramatically. It's not just in sports, but in news coverage, politics, everything else, where all of a sudden media people sort of start to like being a player in the process. It crosses all sorts of lines. You can't trade away your credibility and your integrity on one story, you know, in order to get the next one. That to me is, you know, that's not journalism. Journalism is finding out things that people don't want you to find out and making them public, you know, for a real reason that your audience needs to know or wants to know. And not just on a prurient basis, but, you know, this is important in terms of knowledge and information for a topic that they're very interested in. You know, trading out, you help me here and I'll help you there. I'm not going to deny that sort of stuff hasn't gone on for a long, long time. I just think that it's almost an open marketplace now. And, you know, who ends up having to work with their comments between quote marks, and who gets to be sort of an invisible hand on stories behind the scenes? I mean, that tilts the board, you know, considerably. So I'm leery to grant that sort of thing. When I can talk to an agent and the agent is willing to be quoted, I feel like I'm doing some, you know old-time sports writing at that point, because now it's so rare that an agent or other reps for a player will allow himself to be quoted. He wants his site out there. He wants it to shape the story, but he wants, what's the old Watergate term, plausible deniability?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agents and GMs will often do that. They'll say, I want this on the record because I want to put out this fire. That's part of their jobs is being firemen. And if there's a fire and they got to put it out, they will go on the record and say, look, get this out, get it out as soon as you can, because I got a fire situation on my hands. And, you know, brush fires become forest fires if you don't fight them right. But, Steve, just keeping it on our industry, we've both been around for a while and we've watched the industry evolve. I came up, I did 18 years at the AP. I did 6 at ESPN.
Yeah.
I started a website that lasted almost 5 years. You did about 15 years at the Star Tribune, some time at SI.com, and you've been at NBA.com about 9 years. But we're seeing, especially this season, the industry evolve. The head of the Pro Basketball Writers Association, Josh Robbins, who was with the Orlando Sentinel for a long, long time, he just went over to The Athletic. A bunch of guys are going over to The Athletic. And they have a business model that people are still looking at and kind of scratching their heads. Can they bring in enough revenue without a video component? And I think probably if they add a video component and get themselves a TV channel, that could be a game changer for them. But without a video component, do you see that business model working?
It remains to be seen. I hope it works, if only from the standpoint that I've probably got a dozen, you know, pretty good friends who've gone to work for them, and I want to see them thrive. I certainly don't want to see them face any you know, crisis situation with that. You and I both remember a product called the National, which I think came out around 1990 or so, and it was a print product meant to be a national sports daily newspaper. Well, it was ahead of its time in a sense in that it predated the internet, and by trying to remain a print publication, it was screwed in terms of distribution and deadlines. It could not get late scores in because it had to find presses to get printed so its trucks could roll and it could get distribution in urban areas. It was too much to handle, and it was going head to head with newspapers during newspapers, you know, what was still their late prime, and newspapers often dictated the press time. So it's sort of like, oh, okay, well you can get on the press before us, but we'll be the one that has the late scores. It was not a feasible business model. This one with electronic delivery, delivery in quotes. I mean, you go to them, you can seek them out at any point. They can update. It's great. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. But will people pay for content, you know, in a world where there's so much free content? There's an overload of coverage of all these sports, I think. And you know, you can have high-quality coverage. That's what they do. They hire, you know, some of the best in our business. And I happen to subscribe because I'm in the business. I just wonder whether, you know, your average office worker or school teacher or you know, a plumber is going to fork over money for sports information that, you know, well, he can't get that quality stuff maybe, but he can get what he needs, you know, and not have to pay a dime. So that's the big question. That's the $29 million question, I guess, if you look at what the entrepreneurs that are behind this thing have put up. They've gotten, you know, venture capital, and they've had the seed money to grow at a breakneck pace. I'm surprised by that, and I guess maybe they felt they needed to have the breadth of sports coverage in order to entice people. You know, you're not just subscribing to read about your local teams or a few other cities. You've got the nation. You've got, you know, really North America covered if you factor in Canadian hockey. So, you know, we'll see what happens with it. I hope it works. It's a lot of people have said they think the end game is for the money men to sell to a Google, to an Amazon, you know, a big player, and cash out, and then, you know, maybe hope that at that point the Athletic is such a small line item on the balance sheet of one of these big conglomerates that they don't mess with it for a while. But at some point, they're going to have to carry their weight financially and work in black ink, not red. And you know, that's when, you know, we're gonna see, you know, just what sort of commitment there is, whether it's the current ownership or whether it's a new buyer.
Yeah, you know, paywalls have worked. When I was at ESPN, ESPN Insider was $40, and people were paying the $40, and they were paying it like crazy. And then the economy crashed in 2007, and ESPN lost a whole lot of expected revenue on college sports. They went from a projected profit of something like $200 million to a projected loss of $300 million for the season that they had already paid for the TV rights for. So it's a risky business when you go to a subscription-based site, but it works for the Wall Street Journal. It works in certain markets, and in other markets it just doesn't work. I'm in New York. I can get all the New York Post gives me all the Knicks coverage I could ever want. I get it home delivered, and I can get it free online or on my, on my mobile. So I don't have a need to subscribe to Mike Borkanoff, who hasn't been working the beat for a fraction of the time that Mark Berman has been. But, you know, then you look at a city like Minnesota, where John Krasinski was covering that team for the AP for a long, long time, and he's one of the lead players on breaking news on what's going on with Jimmy Butler. So it's worth it in Minnesota. It might not be worth it in New York. And then we'll see how it pans out in Orlando where Josh has gone over. But, you know, I'm working in a different space. I'm working in the sports gambling journalism space, which is, you know, brand, brand new because the Supreme Court didn't overturn the PASPA until May 14th. And so I'm running into some roadblocks and some obstacles because I work in a gray area. And I work in a segment of the business that where no one's really worked before without it being somehow seen as dirty. But, Steve, you've been researching sports gambling journalism and the sports gambling industry for a story you're working on for NBA.com. What are some of the things that you're finding out?
Well, I mean, you know, I look at it in context, and I remember David Stern, you know, adamant against the idea of an NBA franchise ever in Las Vegas, unless they took our game off the sports books, and that included the All-Star game, which eventually, and lo and behold, in 2007 was in Las Vegas. The warming towards sports betting by Stern, from being absolutely 100% against it, and then now with Adam Silver, I don't want to say courting, but being open-minded to it, and owners.
Well, they took $250 million.
Potential.
They took $250 million dollars from the MGM Grand for information that they were giving away for free. So they're, you know, and MGM Grand is getting some signage, and they're getting some online space, and some partnership stuff. So MGM Grand's is benefiting from a partnership with the NBA. But go ahead, keep talking.
No, but I'm old school. I grew up reading, Connie Hawkins' book Foul, and how involvement in a point shaving scandal, really undermined his career when he was really getting ready to go in Iowa, University of Iowa, and then his early what would have been his pro years, and he was blackballed, and so the orientation of gambling as something that sports should walk away from, run away from, is still there for me, and so I look at this and I think, okay, well. There's always been betting on sports. Nobody's naive enough to think that hasn't gone on and wouldn't continue to go on. But the sports themselves have kept a moat around themselves to keep gambling on the outside. That sense of what you said. Almost like it's dirty, it's illegal. That kept it at bay, even as the money was gargantuan. And now drawbridges are being lowered to invite it in, and I wonder what sort of unintended consequences we're going to see as these leagues embrace it. I know that there's a sense that by making it legal, the integrity will go up. That you won't have to, you're taking it out of the back alleys and the guys with the bent noses. You're able to regulate things and monitor things, and that's allegedly what the NBA's 1%. Integrity fee is all about, the cost that they'll incur to make sure everything stays on the up and up. The more widespread it becomes, who knows? You're going to have all types. So I'm curious to see what it does to the viewing experience. When you watch on television and can place bets on your mobile device and somehow is some of that stuff going to be on the screen? Is that going to alienate people? Are they going to have a secondary channel where you watch the game because, you don't want to taint, there's a loaded word, the broadcast of the sporting competition with all these proposition bets that are, on the crawl underneath or whatever. A lot to be determined still in a culture that I think has been conditioned to be wary of bringing those two together. Tim Donaghy remains an extremely sore subject around the NBA, and the idea of a referee, who doesn't make seven-figure, multi-year guaranteed money like players do, somehow getting involved. That's another potential landmine. So it's sort of uncharted, but it seems to be moving, like I said, at a really fast rate and may get out in front of itself a little bit too much, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to watch over the course of this season. There are five states that now have legal gambling: West Virginia, Mississippi, Delaware, New Jersey, Nevada, Pennsylvania just handed out a couple licenses, and you're gonna have to go to a racetrack to gamble in Pennsylvania, from the way I understand it. But those places are gonna be online within the month. A lot of places wanted to get on before football season started, but you're dealing with bureaucracies and lottery commissions in certain states, gambling commissions, alcoholic beverage commissions, and a lot of these people, I mean, let's just say it, a lot of these people want to get greased before they're going to give out a license. And, hey, look, gambling is corrupt, but the industry does self-police itself very well, and the FBI watches everything. But bureaucracies and governments are corrupt as well, and there's guys
right
waiting to get paid before they're going to give out a license, and you'll see that to different degrees depending on the state. And then when guys get busted, they go to jail. Happens. But anyway, this gives me a chance to plug the folks that are paying the bills for this show. My show is it lives on GetMoreSportsBot.com. But we're sponsored by BetDSI.com, which is one of the largest offshores in the world. If you go to BetDSI.com and you enter bonus code BBALL, that's BBALL, all capital letters, 1,000, they'll match your initial deposit up to $1,000 of U.S. dollars. That's a lot of free money to play with, and you can kind of spread it around and have fun with your bets. Again, it's BetDSI.com, or if you're listening overseas, it's BetDSI.eu. And Steve, I want to just kind of run some odds at you. You tell me what you think, and I'm going to start with the odds to win the NBA championship. Obviously, the Golden State Warriors are prohibitive favorites. They're at minus 250, which means you'd have to wager $250 to win $100. But then the Celtics are at 5-1, and there's nobody else in the East that's close to them. The Sixers are at 18-1, so are the Raptors at 18-1. Bucks are sitting at 110-1. The Pacers are at 130-1. And then, you know, you got outlier teams. There's tons of them. The Knicks are at 250-1, and the Knicks are going to be a top three team when it comes to the lottery. But that's about it. Bulls are 250-1. Pistons, Heat, Miami Heat, Cleveland Cavaliers, Brooklyn Nets, Charlotte Hornets, they're all at 250-1. In my book, Miami at 250-1, they're a trade away from getting Jimmy Butler, and they do have players who work so well in Coach Spoelstra's system. How about them as a legitimate championship contender with Jimmy Butler on the team? Should that trade go down?
Well, I mean, I think they're definitely a cut above. Even as they sit right now, and certainly if they add a piece like Butler, they're cut above some of those other teams with whom they share those 250-1, you know, odds. I just think in terms of rating those teams and the quality and the potential, when you look at the pedigree from Pat Riley on down, I think Eric Spoelstra is, you know, one of the best coaches in the league, and you know, they play hard both sides of the ball. If they add Butler, you know. If you got in while the getting was good on the Miami Heat, that would seem to me it'd be a better possibility than some of those other teams. You know, I still think that with Golden State Warriors, you have to acknowledge just how they've pitched a tent on the NBA Finals, and all these other teams and their odds are they're encouraging, and you know, somebody is going to play them, and somebody might upset them. Houston came within a game last spring of doing that, but the NBA may be among the more predictable of the major sports, barring injuries. And to me, that's the biggest challenge for Golden State this year, is that, you know, we've seen a couple of little injury situations that they have already, and if that's the kind of thing that you know goes on throughout the season, whether it's Draymond Green's sore knee or, you know, sort of nicks and knacks that aging veterans like Iguodala and Livingston might pick up, or, you know, Klay Thompson and you know, or an old ankle thing that rears up on Steph Curry. I mean, that to me, that's the sort of thing that can change the game. But otherwise, the Warriors' depth and style of play, I mean, that's all part of it. It's intertwined. Makes it so hard to imagine that somebody else is going to have that Larry O'Brien trophy.
That's just tremendous stuff, Steve. And man, your insight and your institutional wisdom it's invaluable. There's a lot of us around in this industry, Steve. You know, as long as we keep on ticking, we'll keep an eye on making sure people do things right as best we can, and we'll call them out when needed in the proper ways. And the two of us do that from time to time. Certain guys who see it, especially on Twitter, they get it. The readers don't always get it, and the trolls certainly never get any of it. But you got to feed the trolls on Twitter every now and then. So again, he's Steve Ashburner from NBA.com. I'm Chris Sheridan. You can follow me on Twitter at Sheridan Hoops. You can follow Steve at @AshNBA. And you know, he's definitely worth a read. Anytime he writes on NBA.com, as a lot of those guys are. So that's a wrap. Again, this show it lives on GetMoreSports.com, but we are sponsored by BetDSI.com, or overseas it's BetDSI.eu. And if you go there and you use promo code BBALL1000, that's all capital letters, B-B-A-L-L 1000, they'll match up to $1,000 US right off the bat. And that's a lot of free money to play with. So no matter where you're listening and what your local currency is, you can get $1,000 US matched with that bonus code. Again, it's B-B-A-L-L, all capital letters, 1000. That's a wrap. This is Sports Betting Tips, episode 22, the Jimmy Butler situation. Over and out.